Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A team of literary scholars spent years poring over thousands of pages of text comprising Mark Twain's memoirs. The author of Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and other American classics said they were not to be published until 100 years after his death. The first of three volumes came out last month and has quickly made the bestseller list. The book is titled simply Autobiography of Mark Twain. And Robert Hurst, who is the general editor of the Mark Twain Project, joins me in the studio. I am looking at a book of great weight and thousands of pages. It's just extraordinary, Robert Hurst. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You all did not expect the reaction you've gotten.
No, I don't think we can say that we expected the degree of this reaction. We were aiming at a larger audience than we usually aim at when we publish a scholarly edition. A scholarly edition that, let's say, of his letters would aim at about 2,000 copies.
And so far,
we're up to about 300,000 for this one.
Unbelievable.
Yes, it is unbelievable.
Let's invite our listeners to join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And just to put some accuracy here, Samuel Langhorne Clemens was born in Florida, Missouri, on November 30th, 1835. He died April 21, 1910, at age 74 in Reading, Connecticut. Now, Bob, versions of this autobiography, not this one, mm-hmm. but of an autobiography, have been published before. What is so different here?
Well, let's see if I can do this briefly. The autobiography manuscript is very long. It's several thousand pages, and it was in the Mark Twain papers from the time that Mark Twain died. So it was in the hands, for instance, of his first literary executor, Albert Bigelow Payne, and Payne was empowered really to publish things from the papers, and he actually let no one else do it. And in 1924, he does a two-volume edition of the autobiography, but he knows, and he actually says, that this is really just a third of what the whole thing should be. And he doesn't understand it very well. He thinks that all of the preliminary texts that Clemens wrote between 1870 and 1904 are part of the autobiography. We know now that that's not the case. So he prints only two volumes, and really the first volume is devoted entirely to things. Most of these things aren't in the real autobiography.
Hmm.
Only in the second volume does he get into what is the real autobiography, namely dictations that Mark Twain starts making in 1906.
And what's in the first so-called autobiography?
Well, the first autobiography, that is to say these preliminary things,
yeah.
They are attempts to do an autobiography, which Mark Twain makes over and over and over again for 30 years. He starts and then he stops. He's not satisfied with the way it's going.
I see.
He tries dictating in 1885 about Grant, and he doesn't work out well. He stops that. We have maybe two dozen of these experiments that he makes and then sets aside. He saves things that even that he's not going to publish. And actually, when he finally does settle on how to do the autobiography in 1906, he goes back and looks at all of those, and he picks out one from the earlier ones, and he begins the final form with that one. And he says, this is an early attempt. It's in the old style of chronological narrative, and it didn't work out. And here it is. And that's the first piece that begins the true autobiography. It's actually a wonderful, wonderful piece. He knows it's wonderful, too. He's not giving you something bad. He's too smart for that. But all of the other preliminary things are really not part of the autobiography. They are in this volume, but they are clearly labeled as preliminary. The final one doesn't begin really until about halfway through this book.
So how did this group of scholars mm-hmm. come together and begin to sort out what was not, mm-hmm. what should be included, what should be left out?
Okay. Well, I should have to say that this group of scholars has been, at least many of them, have been together since 1967.
Wow.
Supported continuously by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. We could not have done many of the books that we've done, and we certainly could not have done this one without that kind of continuous support. Because what it did was to train editors in what was in the archive and how to do this and all about Mark Twain for 40 years. And so when they finally came to do this about 6 years ago, there were some experts around, real experts, in how to do this, who managed to kind of think it through, to look through all of the manuscript and to figure out what had not been known before, namely that he had finished it. We had thought for years that this was a series of drafts that he'd left in a sort of inchoate state. It's in a file cabinet. Anyone who came to the papers out in Berkeley could have seen it, and many people did see it. But, of course, it's a little hard to read the manuscript. Part of it's confusing. In any case, these guys started in about 6 years ago. And in 3 years or so, they came to me and said, well, Bob, you know, it's not a series of drafts. It's finished. Huh. We know exactly how he wanted it to begin. We know exactly the order in which he wanted things published, and we know exactly how it ends, because he ends it with when his youngest daughter Jean dies on Christmas Eve, 1909. He sits down and writes a piece about her, and he says, "This is the end of the autobiography." So all of a sudden, you realize that you've been sitting on a manuscript of Mark Twain's last major literary work, thinking that it was incomplete and sort of incoherent. And no, it turns out that isn't the case.
It's interesting to me that right along, though, he said he didn't want anything published until 100 years after his death. And yet you got those previous versions. Mm-hmm. How come?
Well, you see, actually what he says is, I don't want the complete text published until 100 years after my death. And he picks 100 years out of the air, so to speak. I mean, I think of it as a nice, large, round number. I mean, it means a long time after I'm dead.
Because?
Well, because, number one, he didn't want what he had to say about anybody or about anything to damage his reputation or to make people feel like shunning him or to damage his kids' futures or their grandkids' futures. And he wanted the same thing for the people he was criticizing. He said, this is not a revenge record. I want to say what I want to say. I want to say what I think is the truth, but I don't want to damage anybody. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. He's had a rather tender heart for someone who could say as sharp things as he did.
From this autobiography, what is the picture of the man in the most concise terms?
Well, I'll try to be concise, but part of the point is that what you're getting, certainly when you get to the final form of it, is Mark Twain standing there talking to you, talking about whatever occurs to him, changing the subject when he loses the least bit of interest in it and talking about something else. It's like having a conversation with him, but without being able to ask him any questions. Someone else is asking the questions. He's determining what the questions are. So you get a chance to hear Mark Twain talking directly to you. This is unlike any other of his literary works, in which most of those would be through some kind of narrator, some kind of like Huck, or the sophisticated narrator of Tom Sawyer. But this is the person himself, and being very frank and very honest with you, and he really cannot go a page without being funny.
And what kind of a man was he?
That's very hard for me to say. I think my impulse is to want to say, go read it and you tell me what kind of a man he is. But he is clearly someone who has an enormous command over the English language or the American language. He is someone who has very sharp insights into human beings and to the way they behave. And he is someone who can deal with that and make you laugh at it without seeming to have any effort at doing so. This is the most relaxed kind of narrative you're ever going to want to encounter. It is not a narrative, however. It's just this thing, then that thing, then this thing, then that thing. So it covers all kinds of ground without any real plan. Now, people are intimidated by that, but my reaction is Don't be. This is a kind of book that you can jump in and open to any page and start reading. You don't have to have read the earlier parts. That's because it's just all discrete dictations. And I think that when people do read this, they will come away with a different impression of Mark Twain if they've had one to begin with.
Robert Hurst, he's the general editor of the Mark Twain Project. He's official curator of the Mark Twain Papers, housed at the Bancroft Library at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also the editor of Who Is Mark Twain? With a question mark after it. And did the work on this book
Well,
help
I did
you
some
to
of the work. It's important for me to say that I am not the editor of this book. If I were the editor or an editor, I would be on the title page, and I'm not on the title page. I'm the general editor. I'm the guy who opens up the doors and opens the windows and turns on the air conditioning and waits for people to come in and get the work done. That's what I do.
But you're certainly looking over everybody's shoulder.
Don't tell them that. They might be a little intimidated if they thought I was looking over their shoulder.
And we'll certainly invite your questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of Mark Twain's political views, his view of organized religion, his feelings and thoughts about particular people of that age. Stay with us. And we're talking about the autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1. The general editor of the Mark Twain Project is Robert Hurst. We'll call him Bob. He's here in the studio with me. This book is heavy. It's big. I'm stunned that within weeks of publication, this huge autobiography landed on bestseller lists around the country. Here's an email from Peter, who says, "The copy of the Twain biography, a most thoughtful gift from my son for my 65th birthday, is presently weighing down one end of my coffee table. It took 3 people to place it there, and it's only part one," he says. "I'm still on the introduction. What do you think Twain would have had to say about the amount of scholarship elbowing its way into this book?"
Well, I'm not sure I know what Mark Twain would have said. I worked very hard to find out what he actually did say. What he would have said is sort of above my pay grade, but I'll take a guess. Mark Twain was subject to flattery, and he knew it. He loved flattery, loved to be praised, and I think he would at least to some extent regard all this effort and the number of pages even as a kind of praise. I wouldn't say that it's impossible that he wouldn't have something sarcastic or sly to say about editors spending all this time on his work, but I can't actually think of what that would be.
Here's an email from Chris in Bainbridge, Ohio. He says, I'm a fan of Mr. Twain. However, I'm amazed he specified the 100-year restriction on publishing of his autobiography. What made him believe the world would be interested in his commentary 100 years after his death? It seems somewhat arrogant.
Well, I suppose you could call it arrogant, or you could call it self-confident. Mark Twain was quite sure that it would be of interest to the reading public in the future. And he's a man who doesn't lack self-confidence, let's face it. He's a guy who really thinks very highly of his own talents. And he thought very highly of this invention, this new way of doing an autobiography. He was sure, in fact, that, or he said he was sure, that all future autobiographies would be written this way. And, of course, they haven't. It's unlikely they will be written this way. But I think it's quite clear that Mark Twain didn't mean literally 100 years. For instance, as he goes through the manuscript, he says, well, here's one about religion. This one can't be published for 500 years. Or he'll say about this one, this can't be for 50 years. What he's saying really is it can't be published for a long time after I'm dead so that I won't be affected by what it says. People won't come at me and try to hang me or run me out of town. And so that my kids won't suffer from it, and their income from my books won't suffer from it, and their grandkids won't suffer from it. You know, but he wants to protect the people that are going to be damaged by what he says from what he says.
He certainly holds some disdainful views about religion.
Yes, he does. Very much so. I mean, for instance, the things that he says can't be published for 500 years are a series of dictations in which he really does let himself out about that. They're not in this volume. They won't come out until the second volume. They're in June of 1906. But no, there's no question that these are very severe critiques, sarcastic critiques of what we think of as the Christian religion. And they were so sarcastic that when Charles Nider wanted to publish them in 1959 with his edition of the autobiography, Clara Clemens, who was still alive, prevented him from doing so. She thought this would damage her father's reputation to have anyone be able to read what he actually said about Christianity.
Was it organized religion or was it faith?
Well, I mean, he does say faith is believing what you know ain't so, but I do think it is principally organized religion that he has a quarrel with. He doesn't think it's sincere. He doesn't think it's honest, and he doesn't think that it's in touch with reality. So he's got a lot of complaints about it, and they tend to kind of crop up, and his views tend to crop up in almost anything he has to say about religious matters. Even if he's talking about his friend Joe Twitchell, he's likely to kind of twit Twitchell about certain aspects of his faith. He doesn't pull his punches with his friends.
He also takes issue with a great deal that the United States government does. For example, he talks about Mila. He talks about the Philippines War.
Right. I mean, he doesn't talk about Mila because that hasn't happened yet. But he does talk about what we did in the Philippines in the Moro, the execution of the Moros. I mean, basically 600 natives, women and children, hiding in a kind of volcano cone that were surrounded by American troops and basically annihilated from on high. I think we lost something like 15 or 16 soldiers to the fire, and they lost all 650. And he has an extended sarcastic account of this that I'm afraid will read all too much like what we know about goes on even now. My Lai being just an example.
Of course. And so what's going on now would, I'm sure, bring his thoughts to the fore. He wrote quite a few withering comments about various people. Tell us about Francis Paxton.
Well, Francis Paxton is the real name, so-called, of the Countess Massilia, who is the landlady he rents his villa from in Florence when he and the family go there in early 1904 because Olivia, his wife, is suffering from heart disease, and the doctors have recommended the climate of Italy. And this woman, actually an American, proceeds to kind of torture them by all kinds of crazy behavior as the landlady of this villa. I mean, turning off the water, preventing all kinds of things from happening, tearing out the telephone. He goes on. I mean, it's a long, long list of things.
He calls her pestiferous.
Yes, he calls her pestiferous and a lot of other things. When Mark Twain gets going on telling you what he doesn't like about someone, he has a lot of resources that he calls on. He can be a lot of fun if you're not the person being attacked.
He experienced a great deal of tragedy his life. Talk about that.
Well, Mark Twain is, I think, one of the most remarkable people to endure that kind of tragedy. He's sometimes portrayed as a Lear figure, but I think it's actually much more accurate to say that he's resilient beyond belief. He never finally succumbs to any of the things that you and I might succumb to. I mean, when his favorite daughter, Susie, dies at the age of 24 while the family is away. I mean, they're not even home with her when she dies. That's a very big blow. And yet, Mark Twain continues to write after that. He completes an entire book in less than a year.
I was stunned to read what he wrote after she died.
Mm-hmm.
He said her life was beautiful up until then. She died at almost a good moment in her life because she would not have to endure what happened afterwards.
That's correct. And he says, if I had been up to me, I would not have brought her back to life if I could have. I might have brought her back to life for my wife, but not for myself. So he does see this as a kind of, I won't call it justice, but a positive side of her having died young.
And wasn't there even another child who died at a very young age?
Yes. Jean, the youngest, dies before she's 30 in the bathtub of his home in Redding, Connecticut on Christmas Eve Day, 1909. She's an epileptic, and she's been in institutions for a number of months, and she's finally come home and is having a great time decorating the house for Christmas, which was very important to Clemens. And she goes up, she says goodnight to him, and goes up, and the next thing he hears is in the morning that she's died in the bathtub. And that's when he sits down and writes, and this is very typical of Mark Twain, instead of going away and weeping, he sits down and writes a long memoir of her. And he says this is the end of the autobiography. I think that is a very striking thing for him to have done.
Robert Hurst, and we're talking about the autobiography of Mark Twain. And we're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850 to Gainesville, Florida. Good morning, Peter. You're on the air.
Good morning. Great subject. I have a question about Mark Twain's literary use and the occurrences in his own life involving child abuse and the horrific treatment of children. It occurs throughout all of his novels, horrible things that happen to children, and it appears that he had a somewhat desperate youth himself. Is there any record or are there any indications in this new work that Twain himself was not only a subject of abuse, but he may have been an abuser, as is often the case when children are abused, they fall into similar patterns in adulthood. I'm originally from Hartford, and I had heard stories of Twain being accused of improper conduct with children.
Well, I suppose this kind of rumor is inevitable. But I, frankly, have been working on Mark Twain for 45 years. I've never seen any evidence of that anywhere. And I'm talking about evidence. I'm talking about documentation, not rumor, not stories told by people. I would say that it's just wrong to say that Mark Twain abused his children. There's just no evidence of that. At one point, he does say he discovers that they were afraid of him. This is one way of thinking about abuse, I suppose, but this is a man with a temper. And as his oldest daughter, Susie, says, we all have a temper in this family. And so it doesn't surprise me that young kids might be afraid that, their dad would blow up in ways that they couldn't anticipate, but that is a very far thing from abuse. And so I don't think there's really any substance to the notion that he abused his own children or, frankly, that he himself was abused. Now, when Mark Twain is growing up in Missouri, he is in a family that has been deprived of its father, of its earning individual. He is put out to work, really, at the age of 11 or 12 because he won't go to school. His older brother is already a typesetter. He becomes a typesetter. And there's no indication to me that his family abused him. Now, being an apprentice typesetter in Missouri was not exactly a bowl of cherries. You got only hand-me-down clothes, as he says. He talks about this in the autobiography. You only got hand-me-down clothes, and you basically had a kind of rough life. You weren't paid anything, and you couldn't go anywhere. But he makes the best of it. He turns himself into a perfectly good typesetter and eventually joins his brother on the Hannibal News and goes on from there. So I don't know where those rumors come from. Doesn't surprise me that they're out there, but I don't think they have any basis in fact.
Robert Hurst, he's general editor of the Mark Twain Project. We're talking about the autobiography of Mark Twain, the first of three volumes just released and already very much a bestseller. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. One thing I wanted to ask you about while Twain was training to be a steamboat pilot on the Mississippi River. He convinced his younger brother to work with him.
Well, he basically got him a job on the steamboat where Sam was actually a pilot, or actually an apprentice pilot. He wasn't actually a pilot. He was still an apprentice at that point. And Henry was living in St. Louis and not, just sitting around not doing anything. So it was kind of a favor as far as he was concerned that he would get his brother a job as what's called the mud clerk. It's the third level of clerk on a steamboat. And then you're called mud clerk because you had to get off the boat when it landed and your feet got muddy. In any case, Henry is on the Pennsylvania, and he actually is hit by the actual pilot when Sam is in the pilot house, and Sam attacks the pilot, knocks him down and wrestles with him, lets the boat go on its own down the river, beats this guy up, and then is separated from him by the captain. The captain says, you basically cannot stay on this boat. You have to go back to St. Louis on some other boat. So he does. But that means he leaves Henry behind. And then the Pennsylvania on the trip up from New Orleans blows up and kills a lot of people. We don't actually know how many people. 100 wouldn't be a far big mistake. And among them is Henry Clemens, who survives for several days but then dies of his wounds in Memphis. So that's a kind of a deep black moment for Mark Twain. He is not a believer at this point, but he actually says, I stopped and prayed to ask God to let this cup pass from my lips. So he was very bitter about it. He was very deeply touched by it. It didn't, however, prevent him from going back on the river. That's another example of what I would call Mark Twain's resilience. He feels it very deeply, but it doesn't incapacitate him.
And what about his relationship with his wife, Olivia Livy?
Well, it's a wonderful relationship. I mean, if you've studied anything of the Victorian period, you're going to have a tough time finding someone who was absolutely loyal to his wife for a long, long, long time, for their entire marriage from 1870 to 1904 when she died. She is a wealthy young lady, or rather from a wealthy family, with some education, and great loyalty to him. How did they meet? It's a very good question. When Mark Twain goes off on the Quaker City in 1867, this is with a bunch of folks from around the country who want to go to the Holy Land and see what that's all about. They're very religious. They're rather old. But there are also some folks on the boat who are younger, including a man named Charlie Langdon, who is Olivia's younger brother. He becomes one of the Quaker City Nighthawks, as Mark Twain calls them. They have fun. They play poker and so forth and so on. And so when he gets back, he's actually introduced to the family, and he meets Olivia Langdon. They go to hear Dickens read in New York City at the end of 1867. And then Mark Twain goes on New Year's calling day, just after that event, and Olivia's at this place where he's calling, and he said he had 30 calls on his list, and he managed to kind of postpone 29 of them until next year, because he stayed there all the day talking to Olivia. And then all of a sudden, he has to go out to California to take care of something that having to do with the book that he's writing. And when he does come back, he goes out to Elmira, and he proposes to Olivia within a matter of days.
We're talking about the autobiography of Mark Twain with Robert Hurst. Short break and right back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices. At NovoNordisk-US.com. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by Cabot Creamery Cooperative, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar cheese, and offering recipes, stories, and programs for schools at CabotCheese.coop. This is NPR.
There is no longer an entity called Black America, writes Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and MSNBC analyst Eugene Robinson. He says Black America is now divided into four groups: the abandoned poor, the mainstream middle class, the wealthy and powerful, and immigrants and people of mixed race. On the next Fresh Air, Robinson talks about the splintering of Black America. Join us.
And welcome back. Mark Twain is our subject in this hour. We are talking about a new autobiography put together by many scholars over the past 6 years. However, my guest, Robert Hurst, has been working on Mark Twain for 40 years or so. Let's go back to the phones to Saugus, Massachusetts. Good morning, Carol.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I just wanted to comment when you had asked if he had lost a child very young. I read a biography of Mark Twain years ago, and I believe he had three daughters and a son, and the son died at 2 years old according to the book. Mark Twain had taken the boy out for a carriage ride just for some air, and he caught a chill and died. So basically three of his four children died before he did, and I think that's pretty much a tragedy.
I should say, Bob Hurst?
Well, that's essentially correct. I mean, we have to remember that in the 19th century, infant mortality was considerably higher than it is today. In Mark Twain's own family, he loses two of his siblings, Margaret and Benjamin, before he himself grows up. Only four of the seven children in that family reach maturity. But your memory is correct. Langdon was born in November of 1870. He dies somewhere in the area of April 1872. The story that Mark Twain gives in the autobiography of his having been the cause of this death, namely being taking him for a carriage ride and getting distracted and allowing him to be uncovered, we know is not true. We know it's not true because his sister-in-law, Susie Crane, who was intimately involved with all this, close to him at all times, writes a long letter to his autobiographer, to his biographer, Payne, and explains in great detail that his memory that he was the cause of this is simply wrong. And
how does she recall it's happening?
Well, she recalls that it was not the disease and not the cause that he remembers. He dies in the spring in Hartford, and not in the winter.
In the winter,
and I mean it's a very circumstantial account. Mm. And she says, among other things, that Sam Clemens had this propensity for taking blame for things that he really wasn't to blame for. And I think that is widely recognized among scholars as a characteristic of Mark Twain.
Here's an email from R.L. who says, can you clarify Mark Twain's church going? I understood that he, along with people like Harriet Beecher Stowe, attended the Congregational Church on occasion, which has always been highly critical of church and self-critical even as churchgoers. If this is true, does leaving this out distort our perception of Twain's view of church?
Well, I hope we aren't leaving it out. We do report exactly what he does do with respect to church. One of his best friends in Hartford is Joe Twitzel, who is the longtime minister of the Asylum Congregational Church. And we know that Mark Twain frequently attended this church, even though he was, by all other accounts, a non-believer. I think you'd have to say that Mark Twain recognized the social function of anything like a church. And he recognized that it was important for the community to be able to come together in that way, whether or not they believed in the supernal God that was supposedly they were praying to. So I don't think it's fair to say that we leave out of an account his attendance on church. We just don't make of it quite what I think you're making of it.
All right. To Dayton, Ohio. Brian, good morning.
Good morning. I have two quick questions. First, what was Twain doing during the beginning of the Civil War in 1861? I think he would have been about 26 then, and I know he went west. And the second question is, I see that his mother lived until she was 87. What was his relationship with her as he grew older and as she did?
Well, let's see if I can remember both questions.
I'll have them for you.
Okay. What was he doing at the beginning of the Civil War? Mark Twain was a full-fledged licensed pilot going up and down the Mississippi when the war broke out. He was on the last boat to get through the blockade that was put at the top of the river. And soon thereafter, he joined a militia group of about a dozen of his friends that were ostensibly preparing to kind of resist the invasion of the Union forces. The governor of Missouri was interested in seceding, but of course Missouri did not secede. In any case, he only stays with that group for 2 weeks, and it's a kind of
ragtag group.
I mean, there's not members of the Southern forces. They're simply state militia. In any case, his older brother Orion is appointed by Lincoln to be the Secretary of Nevada Territory. Orion has been helping Lincoln get elected, and so Orion now has to go out to Nevada. He doesn't have any money to get there. Clemens has been earning money as a pilot, so they go out together, and he's anticipating that he will serve the secretary as his secretary, but of course that doesn't quite work out. He thinks that the war will be over in 2 or 3 months, and of course it's not. And so he goes out to Nevada, works for his brother for a brief period, and then gets interested in silver mining and prospecting and so forth and so on.
So he stays out there.
He stays out there. When he runs out of money looking for silver or gold, he never finds any. He takes a job as a newspaper reporter in Virginia City on the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise, which is a remarkable newspaper that allowed him to do exactly what he was best at, to make up news and to write fiction and also to be an excellent reporter of various real things like the territorial legislature. It's a kind of training that no one else, I suppose, who ever became a famous literary figure ever had.
And then did he move on to California or stay
He definitely moved on to California. He got himself involved in a challenge, carrying a challenge for a duel, which was illegal in Nevada territory, and he could easily have been arrested and imprisoned for doing so. So he's advised to leave town, and he does. He goes to San Francisco, and he gets a job on the on a newspaper there, and then that ends after about 4 months. He's not really a very good reporter, and then he takes various other jobs, writing literary works for the Californian and for the Golden Era. But eventually comes up against a kind of block. He really doesn't know what to do with himself. He knows he has this talent, but being a humorist meant accepting a kind of low social position, and he wasn't about to do that. So it's not really until the end of 1865 that he makes up his mind that he is actually going to take advantage of this humorous talent, this talent for humorous literature, which he says literature of a low order, i.e. humorous. And from that point on, end of 1865 on, he is aimed at becoming something, doing something with this talent. And I would say that in 20 years, he changes the public perception of what a humorist is to the kind of thing that we think of as the author of Huckleberry Finn.
And Brian's second point in regard to his relationship with his mother.
Well, his relationship with his mother is one of those things that we can't know enough about, let me put it that way. It's always a very playful relationship, and it's always a very, humorous relationship in the sense that he's always joking with her and she's joking with him. There's an anecdote in this autobiography about her talking about his being a sickly child, and he says, "Well, I guess you were worried that I wouldn't live." And she pauses and said, "No, worried that you would." And there are many such anecdotes. Now, the downside of it is that when his sister-in-law, Molly, dies, he's away, and she has charge of all of his correspondence with his mother. And the executor writes and says, "What should he do with these letters?" And Mark Twain says, "Burn them." And the executor, unfortunately, did.
Burn them. Here's an email from Marcia, who says, "Sam Clemens' mother had a great influence in building awareness and sympathy for slaves in Hannibal, Missouri, and the Clemens family rented a young slave boy. This experience shows up in Twain's writings. I'd like to hear Bob Hurst's comments on this."
Well, that's a very perceptive remark. The story that I think you're remembering, which does occur in the autobiography, is about Sandy. As you say, Sandy was not a slave owned by the Clemenses, but rented. They originally did own slaves, but they were too poor to maintain ownership. So when they needed help, they rented them. And the story that Clemens tells about himself is that Sandy would be always singing. And he was singing incessantly, and it annoyed Sam. And he goes to his mother and says, "Wouldn't you please, you know, tell Sandy to shut up?" And his mother says, "Now, look, you know, he's been separated from his family. He doesn't have a family any longer. And so when I hear him singing, I know that he isn't thinking about his family. He's thinking something more positive, something happier. And that's why..." Clemens says, I dropped my objection, basically, to his singing. I think it's a classic case of Mark Twain telling a story about himself that is part of the education that he's receiving from his family and the education he's receiving over a long time about what his relationship to blacks is going to be, something that was not typical outside of Missouri.
Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning. thank you. I was wondering, I had read the War Prayer, and I was surprised by it because it was well written, of course, but against war. And I was surprised to read in the book that it said he didn't want it published until after his death. And you mentioned that some of that earlier. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering, in his anything that you found, has he mentioned anywhere about the war, or how he felt about war, and whether it was just that matter of that time, if for him to have published that or come out with it, it would have been devastating to him? I just wasn't sure what the reason was that he wouldn't publish it.
Well, I think we know just a little bit about this. Actually, he writes it, and when he writes it in 1905, he is under contract to the Harpers to offer them anything that he does write. They get basically what's called first refusal, and he sends it to Harper's Bazaar, which is actually a woman's magazine. It's not what you would call a kind of political magazine by any means. And he actually sends that in something else, and they accept the something else. I can't remember what that other thing is. And they turn this down. They send it back. They say it's not suitable for a women's magazine. And Dan Beard, who was one of his favorite illustrators, is there and when this happens. And he says, I guess I'm really not going to be able to publish it now in my lifetime. And he says, basically, I understand why Colonel Harvey would not be able to publish this. He has a responsibility to his shareholders. So I will keep it and let it be published after I'm dead.
Robert Hurst, and we're talking about the autobiography of Mark Twain. And speaking of war, did he converse directly with General Grant?
Oh, absolutely. He was a good friend of Grant's and admired Grant for all kinds of reasons, not just his performance in the war, which was extraordinary, but for his ability to write and to speak clearly as well. This is something that he had a kind of fundamental little feeling about with Grant, and he is instrumental, I would say, in persuading Grant to write his memoirs, and then also instrumental in getting them published in a way that was going to make a lot of money for the Grant family. Grant is writing these memoirs when he's dying of throat cancer, and he's actually suffering as he's going along and basically not sure that he can complete it. Mark Twain helps him get it done, and then he publishes it for him through Mark Twain's own publishing house. And I think the ultimate, royalty check to the Grant family, because Grant dies shortly after it's completed, I think even before it's published, the royalty check is on the order of $500,000.
Interesting. To Waxahachie, Texas.
Hi.
Good morning, Natalie.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure. Go right ahead.
I have what they call a slim volume called Mark Twain's Autobiography and First Romance.
Burlesque autobiography, yes?
I bet you know about it. It's published in 1871.
Yes. I do know about it. Doesn't it say burlesque autobiography?
That's where I was going.
Is a burlesque. I mean, Mark Twain was interested in autobiography for a long time, and this is an example of something that he is hoping to make a lot of money on fast. So he puts it into a little tiny pamphlet that's issued. He hopes it's going to be issued for Christmas in 1870. It's delayed until March 1871, and it sells dozens and dozens of copies, but it doesn't really make any money. I mean, and the burlesque autobiography is just exactly that. It's all about his ancestors and how each and every one of them was destined to be hung and how some of them actually were hung.
And here's the last email from John in Mooresville, North Carolina. He says, last night, actor Hal Holbrook was in my hometown of Elmira, New York, performing his one-man Mark Twain Tonight. It would have been Mark Twain's 175th birthday. The crowd sang happy birthday to the actor Twain. Elmira is the home of his wife Olivia, the final resting place of Samuel Clemens. To echo your point about Twain's popularity, the show was a sellout. But one of our callers wants to know whether anything in this autobiography might change that performance.
I don't believe it will. That is to say, I don't think there's anything in here which has that kind of disruptive or contrary effect. It's partly because the manuscript for the autobiography, from which this is based, of course, has been available to scholars for years. We use it all the time to annotate his letters and things like that. And so anything that is radical or unknown has been sussed out long ago. I think, no, this will give you, I think, a reaffirmation of your positive view of Mark Twain. It'll be a kind of more intimate view than you've ever had before. It's like listening to Mark Twain talk directly to you, having a conversation with you on the back porch.
Robert Hurst, he's general editor of the Mark Twain Project, official curator of the Mark Twain Papers. We've been talking about autobiography of Mark Twain. This is the first of three volumes. It is absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.